Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Can I welcome you to this meeting of the Global Strategy Forum? I think it's probably a unique occasion because not only the quality of our speakers, but also the subject matter is one of I think, going to be of particular interest. I should incidentally point out that today's proceedings are being recorded by the BBC Radio 4, and may appear on a BBC Radio 4 programme. So do bear that in mind if at any stage you contribute and wish your views to be preserved for posterity. As you'll be aware, the subject matter, it's described as a debate on whether can the use of torture ever be justified. When you have a debate, you would normally expect to have one person speaking for and the other speaking against. I think the organisers perhaps might have hoped that might have been possible, but for reasons you'll have to speculate on, we are not quite having a debate in the sense of for and against the use of torture, but we are certainly going to have two perspectives on torture and on its the significance of it, of what has been happening in recent times, and on the extent to which it may or may not ever be justified in terms of public policy. The subject has been one of quite a high profile in recent years, particularly because of what's perceived to be the policy under the Bush administration in the United States and the very robust views of Vice President Dick Cheney. Before we in the United Kingdom get too smug, you might like to be aware, if you're not already aware, that so far as one element of this issue, the question of extraordinary rendition, the first recorded example of extraordinary rendition did not take place in the United States, nor did it take place in Eastern Europe or the Soviet Union. It actually took place in the United Kingdom. Some 300 years ago, the use of torture was abolished in England in 1640, but not in Scotland until after the Act of Union in about 1708. And in about 1680, during the reign of King Charles II, there was an attempt on his life, and one witness and one suspect in this matter were rendered to north of the border in order that they could be encouraged to be more open in the evidence they wished to share with the prosecuting authorities. They were convicted, they were executed, and we should at least bear that in mind.
Were they convicted and executed in Scotland?
That I'm not quite certain, but I'm not sure it made much difference from their point of view. but certainly that was the end product. Now, ladies and gentlemen, our two speakers today, the first who I will call upon to speak is Ambassador Tom Pickering, and Tom Pickering is one of the United States' most senior ambassadors. He has served in almost every part of the world as ambassador, ambassador to the United Nations, ambassador to Russia, ambassador to Israel, to Jordan, India, I think, and other parts of the globe. So he has remarkable experience across a wide spectrum and is rightly seen to be one of the most senior spokesmen, even since he retired from the State Department, of the United States. The other speaker, of course, is well known to you, Michael Howard. And in the context of today's discussion, Michael, of course, served as Home Secretary in the government from 1993 to 1997, where he kept his colleagues, including myself, under good control when it came to matters involving the Home Office. And since then, he has served as leader of the Conservative Party, leader of the opposition, and takes a particular interest and has a tremendous experience of legal matters. So without further ado, I'm going to invite Tom Pickering to speak first, then Michael. We'll then have the opportunity for a question and answer for discussion, and we would intend to bring the meeting to a conclusion and not later than 2 o'clock. Tom.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'm delighted to be here. Just a few truths before I begin to talk. I'm not a lawyer, not qualified in the law. I'm not familiar with British issues. I have served a number of American administrations. I've been asked to serve on at least one advisory group to the new administration that has nothing to do with this subject. I'd like to begin with a simple, humble answer to the question that we are now considering. Can torture ever be justified? My simple, humble answer is no. Like all simple answers, it is neither sufficient nor, in my view, necessarily on its own, entirely persuasive. So let me, if I can, lay out some of the thinking, some of the thought, at least, that I have from the other side of the Atlantic on this particular difficult and important problem. I think the first set of questions I want to discuss are in the realm that I think we would all call moral, legal, and historical. Not that they can all be conflated at one time. But they have a set of interrelated reasons that I think are important, perhaps in some cases most important to consider in this particularly trying and difficult problem. There is, in my view, certainly a juridical and moral basis. The chairman just pointed out that both England and Scotland, the latter after a certain delay, did themselves decide that this was an abominable practice and stopped it. An ethic that makes torture an abomination is, in my view, a correct ethic and one in which we now have, I think, a great deal of the world, at least in pledging their commitments on this particular point, on the right side of the issue. And it seems in some ways that the first point is obviously the awful damage that this kind of behavior does to its victims, but that there are other and perhaps even less direct but important arguments which have to do with the question of damage that it does. It does damage, obviously, to its perpetrators, as we see, and it does damage, no less subtle to the societies in which this kind of practice is carried forward in both a personal and a substantive sense, and certainly it leads, in fact, to what one would have to call the development of a perverse series of non-standards for behavior. It opens the door, in some ways, to the kind of behavior that all of us find reprehensible, particularly in modern democracies. And so it is important, I think, to cover it from that point of view. For Americans, there is a juridical basis that's well established, certainly in our history, if not always followed to the letter in practice in the United States, unfortunately. And we are, once again, up against that kind of dilemma and engaged in that kind of a debate in our country. Our Constitution and its Bill of Rights, which, as you all know, were almost immediate amendments to assure that it was fully adopted by the 13 original states. Amendment number 8 rules out cruel and inhuman punishment, a clause which has been and still is being interpreted by the courts in the United States, but in a manner which continually broadens the application of the cruel and inhuman punishment document rather than narrows the application. And while it relates directly to treatment post-trial and conviction following a finding of guilty, it also sets a standard for all persons being held in custody in any status by the United States. In addition to that, interestingly enough, although there is a huge debate going on in the United States continually on this question, our Constitution adopts international law, indeed, as a part of the juridical structure of the United States. And there may be arguments about whether it prevails over later legislation or not, but in a very strong sense, international law is a significant element in this. And of course, internationally, there is a convention to which the United States and others belong, which plays a very, very large role in both defining and indeed proscribing certain kinds of activity with respect to torture. Since most of the recent controversy has also surrounded the issue of conflict, there are laws and rules of land warfare that are very, very important with respect to this. But most broadly, I'd like to turn for a few minutes to the Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman, or Degrading Treatments or Punishments, which is very, very broad in scope and sweeping and unexceptionable in its application in terms of its binding character. Parties under the treaty are to take all effective measures in legislation, administration, or juridical areas to prevent acts of torture in their territory or under their jurisdiction. So it is a very broad and sweeping document in its application. No exceptional circumstances, including war or threat of war or internal instability or other public emergency, may be invoked to justify the use of torture under this convention. Superior orders may not be used to justify torture. And torture is carefully and somewhat exhaustively defined, and I beg your pardon if I read the definition because I think it is helpful at least to understand how sweeping it is. Any act by which severe pain or suffering, whether physical or mental, is intentionally inflicted on a person for such purposes as obtaining from him or a third person information or a confession, punishing him for an act he or a third party has committed or is suspected of having committed, or intimidating or coercing him or a third person for any reason based on discrimination of any kind when such pain or suffering is inflicted by or at the instigation of or with the consent or acquiescence of a public official or other person acting in any official capacity. I'm sorry for that long and somewhat tortured phrase, if you'll pardon the comparison, but it is in many ways, I think, so sweeping a definition as to, in fact, compel the answer that I gave you as no, particularly with respect to the international obligations of states which are party to the convention. Thus, it admits seemingly of no leeway, even in a situation of the most narrow and seriously defined threat to states. Further, the treaty contains strictures against what have been termed in the United States as rendition, when it is used specifically to deliver a person to another state where there is a chance that that person will be tortured. States are prohibited from using evidence that might be obtained by torture, again going back to your 17th century analogy, Mr. Chairman, as a result of torture, except against someone who is accused of being a torturer. So there is one place where evidence produced by torture has a relevance in the scheme of things, but it is incidental and certainly no justification in any way at all for the use of torture. States are also bound to prevent cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment, something of a lesser standard, perhaps, with respect to the intensity of the efforts, which do not amount to torture, in the words of the Convention. The United States became a party to the treaty on November 20, 1994. I think the United Kingdom was an original party. While history is replete with the use of torture, justified by many, many reasons, from the theological to the practical, there is presently in international jurisprudence no loophole which I can see, which can be, or which has been, I think, fashioned in any way to permit torture. And setting aside for a moment Vice President Cheney, there is no occasion when it has been used where there has not been public outcry and indeed significant support for the notion that it represents unacceptable behavior. I'd like in that context to turn just for a few minutes to some opinions that have been collected from the public on this issue, which in a democracy is not an irrelevant situation, not an irrelevant factor. Recent polling within the month has shown a solid sample of Americans, for instance, in favor of the following. 6 in 10, which is not necessarily a high number, but in the aftermath certainly of 9/11, is an important number, approve of an international convention saying that governments should never use physical torture to get information. A majority opposes nearly all coercive measures against detainees to obtain information in the United States. And respondents were presented with a scenario. A detainee is likely to have information on a terrorist attack that could prove critical to stopping the attack. Majorities, in light of this scenario, oppose the use of all of the following: stressful positions, the use of threatening dogs, extreme heat or cold, making a detainee go naked, holding their head underwater, punching or kicking, applying electric shock, in numbers starting with stressful positions at 56%, up to 81% on shocks. Sleep deprivation was opposed by 52% of the American public in this poll. A large majority of Americans, 79%, favored offering incentives. And even those who said that prohibitions against physical torture in their lights are too restrictive did not want to eliminate international norms against torture. There was overwhelming support, 8 and 10, to give detainees the right of habeas corpus, requiring the government to show cause for holding a person in custody. The majority shift in favor of physical torture, interestingly enough, took place primarily among people who identified themselves with the Republican Party. And this is not a political comment, because I think the explanation relates very clearly to what the organizer of the polling concluded. The director of the poll commented that the reason may well be that they did not want to have the former American administration held to account on these issues, something, interestingly enough, that seems to be shared by the leader of the current administration with respect to his stand. On a broader world basis, a similar poll in 19 countries showed that in 14, most people favored an unequivocal rule against the use of torture, even where terrorists might have information that could save human lives. Large majorities in all 19 countries favored a general prohibition against torture. Three countries you will be interested had the highest percentage against the use of torture and favored no exception where lives were at risk, Spain, France, and the United Kingdom at 82%. Similar positions were taken at much lower levels in India, 59%, Nigeria, 54%, Turkey, 51%, and there was a plurality in Thailand of 44%. The necessarily interesting, I think, points are that in addition to France, Spain, and the UK at 82%, Mexico in public was 73%, China 66%, interesting, and the Palestinian territories, not surprisingly, at 64%. Russia at 49%, Iran at 43%. The poll had an error range of plus or minus 2 to 4%. Only 9% of the people in the worldwide poll said there should be no rules against torture. Against the backdrop of historical, moral, juridical, and popular expressions generally against any justified use of torture, let's look at possible worst-case issues. I recognize that these could become arguments, obviously, against interest in any debate of this sort, but I think they deserve to be considered. An examination of these issues and the arguments need to be addressed have to be put in perspective, in my view, and evaluated if the case against the use of torture is to continue to have any substance. The first point that needs to be made is that not only does torture harm the victim, as I said earlier, but it undermines the society using it, and those who do so do not support moral principles to protect the public in general and undermine respect for the rule and indeed the place of law in society. They aid and abet societies which can play fast and loose, as I mentioned a moment ago, with these rights, and they lead to disintegration and collapse. One only has to look at Germany in the unfortunate period of the 30s and the 40s, or the Soviet Union in the same period, to see and understand some of the impact. Similarly, particularly for those who wish to protect military personnel and official civilians serving overseas for their countries, know and understand the meaning of reciprocity, and indeed the impact that the use of torture by one side has in the treatment of individuals who become captive in conflict on the other side. Similarly, there are cases that regarding captured or detained enemies that open up, obviously, the possibility, as I mentioned a moment ago, of gross mistreatment of your own citizens in similar circumstances. It also makes your government and officials fully subject, in my view, to war crimes, and indeed to the perspective of the application of those rules, both during and at the end of conflict. Finally, we have a serious question of truly how effective is torture as a device for providing the truth. There is an interesting story. I was ambassador to Israel between 1985 and the beginning of 1989. Israel, which stands in as much danger, perhaps, as any other state in these kinds of instances shows a history of this particular question as well as any other. I was ambassador to Israel in mid-1985 to the end of 1988, the beginning of 89. During this period, there were horrendous attacks by bombs on public buses in Israel. During one of them, the Shabak, known better as the Shin Bet, the Internal Intelligence Service, was accused of torturing and executing terrorists on the scene, both as desperate efforts to elicit information to thwart expected coordinated additional attacks and also to punish the perpetrators. The case went to the Israeli Supreme Court, which on the question of torture made a close and very controversial decision, decided that in many or some extreme circumstances, some physical pressure could be used to try to protect against a subsequent attack and save lives. The decision was momentarily very popular in Israel, but was also widely subject to debate and indeed disputed by some. A decade later, a similar case arose in the same court. A new Chief Justice, interestingly, a former Attorney General of Israel, presided over the court, and the court decided to the contrary and reversed its earlier decision. It is not known if any attacks were thwarted, certainly by the production of evidence, but the court was forthright on the unacceptability of even a limited application of torture. And on top of all of this, there were obviously deep questions of debate having to do with the definitions that the first court decision attempted to apply to the issue. It is important to raise the question, of course, of what results can be expected from this approach. And as with most issues, there are several possible outcomes. One is, of course, you can obtain the truth. And some insist that in some cases this has been the case. The second option is you get nothing. The victim is willing to risk pain and death for his cause. The third is you get lies and prevarication, false trails and cover stories, especially if buying time is important to the victim of torture. And the fourth is that you get some mixture of truth and falsehood, necessarily probably insufficient to resolve the issue at hand, but giving you some leads. If the issue is of one of war, terrorism, or other conflict, and if urgency is the criterion most used to justify the application of torture, I'm forced to conclude that the likely outcomes will be options 2 through 4, and probably not option 1, but we do not know. Indeed, this could well serve, obviously, in broader perspective, to do more damage to the public interest in whose favor it was supposed to be working by setting up either false trails or leading authorities to act where the public was disrupted, arresting innocent people and creating greater chaos, and indeed undermining some of the moral fiber and indeed the basis of the society being involved. There are some other considerations, and some have been suggested by the scenario of captured terrorists holding information which could save innocent lives. One person who's commented extensively on this has remarked that these circumstances are extremely rare. Public opinion has apparently at least commented on that point, if not totally absorbed it, but intrinsically, if not overly, the polls have continued to show, as I noted, a disinclination to believe that torture should be used by governments, even in cases of extreme need. And people at rock bottom are certainly those most likely to be the innocent victims and those most likely to be helped if torture were widely believed to be an effective approach to saving innocent lives. There is another final important point as well. All of the interest in saving innocent lives has proceeded on the basis that there is no other effective way to extract information about terrorist plots and attacks. Of course, that's not true. All kinds of interrogation information has been developed over the years from human sources and technical collection, and it is also true that much of this has been developed by successful efforts to exploit detainees for critical information without the use of physical pressure. Some of it, I think, more effective and more reliable than the use of torture, the so-called ability to turn people to be cooperative and helpful in a long-term basis. If you are interested, I recommend you take a look at a book called The Interrogators, about debriefing Al-Qaeda and Taliban detainees in Afghanistan. The offer awakes many key points. A key one is that torture only sets back the ability to derive good information through persuasive interrogation techniques, and that there are non-forceful techniques which can be used to provide information which is valid and actionable. These relate often to psychological and human personality factors, which are effective in creating the conditions for providing information. Some involve rewards, others involve using misleading or false information to extract cooperation. None of these contradict either the Convention on contradict the Convention or the rules of war. The authors of the book list 15 typical standard approaches that are used to exploit and indeed to develop information through interrogation, using real incentives and other approaches that I think probably you would all find interesting to look at. Smart interrogation accommodation, in this case of perhaps a softer approach coupled with the ability to develop uncertainties in the detainee's mind about which particular approach that individual should take to the future, have been helpful in extracting cooperation and information of value. It is also true that they don't work on all detainees. The worst case that I can think of for testing all of this would be to have a terrorist in your possession who knows about a weapon of mass destruction placed in the center of your largest city, where you have a very limited amount of time to try to determine whether, in fact, you can locate this weapon through the detainee. This is, of course, a very difficult scenario. Happily, we have not had one yet. Whether we will in the future or not, I leave open as far as that's concerned. As I have pointed out, just in terms of the number of responses open to the detainee for confusion and indeed for making difficulties with the authorities that the detainee is confronted by, particularly I think under cases of torture, one has to at least be somewhat skeptical about whether torture can provide the answer to that particular set of activities. In some cases, obviously, it may provide the disanswer. It may actually provide sufficient information to hide the weapon, to mislead authorities, and to take them elsewhere. We just don't know. The bottom line conclusion in the book that I mentioned to you is interesting. The author does not deny that torture, physical pressure, might in some cases assist, but he comes out against it because it does more moral harm to those who use it and those against what it uses, and creates a greater incentive and recruitment tool for against those against whom it is practiced, making the outcome of any long-term struggle more problematic for those who use torture than the other way around. Let me conclude here, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for the opportunity to set out some of these thoughts.
Thank you very much indeed, Tom, for that very impressive and remarkable legal, ethical, and practical study of the whole issue of torture. Now, for a second perspective, I invite Michael Howard to address us.
Well, thank you very much, Mark. I hope that too many of you won't leave this afternoon under the impression that you were given a false prospectus as to what was likely to happen, because not only have you not had and are you not likely to get a debate between two protagonists of conflicting viewpoints, I'm not even sure that you're likely to get two different perspectives. You might even get the same perspective, because I agree with very much of what Tom has just said. But let me try, since I guess this is what I'm here to do, to inject a couple of notes of controversy into our discussion to see if I can provoke something at least resembling a debate. The first observation that I'd make is that, in a sense, the question which we are here to discuss is too easy to answer. Can torture ever be justified? I don't think you'd find a single head of government who would give anything other than a negative answer to that question. President Bush would have given the answer no, unequivocally, to that question. He did frequently say the United States does not engage in torture? Vice President Cheney would have given the same answer to that question. Everyone in a position of responsibility and authority would give the same answer to that question. But as with so many things, the devil is in the detail. And the detail in this case is, how do you define torture? Because I believe that the previous administration of the United States engaged in a number of specific activities. Tom mentioned some of them. Waterboarding, extreme sleep deprivation, extremes of heat and cold, which they did not define as torture, but which I, and I think perhaps most people in this room, would define as torture. And so in order to get a meaningful answer to the question, and it then becomes a much more difficult question, you have to condescend to the detail, and you have to try and draw up a defined list of activities which either do or do not constitute an act of torture. And Michael Ancram, the chairman and founder of this organization, as a member of the Intelligence Committee of the House of Commons, has, together with the rest of that committee, been charged by the government, as I understand it, with drawing up a list of such activities. And if indeed we could come up with a list of activities which would secure a broad measure of agreement, both nationally and internationally, then I think we would really have made a very significant contribution to the outcome of this debate. The question then, can torture ever be justified, would be a much more meaningful and a much more relevant question. Of course, the starting point for any such body of work would have to be the United Nations Convention, and Tom read out the wording of the Convention. But the Convention inevitably, understandably, uses general terms. It doesn't condescend to specific activities. And I would contend that in order to get any measure of international, I hope this may be unrealistic, universal agreement which would be meaningful and practical in terms of the answer to this question, you need an internationally agreed set of definitions which condescend to particular activities, and you need to say this is or this is not torture. So that's the first little stirring point that I want to introduce into our discussion. The second is even more controversial, and Tom, of course, touched upon it at the end of his remarks. I subscribe to the view that no government can ever authorize or justify torture. And as I've indicated, I would give it a broader definition, certainly, than that which was given to the term by the previous administration of the United States of America. But what would we do? What would any of us do if we were an anti-terrorist officer or a security service officer and we were confronted by someone we believe to be a terrorist, someone we had very good intelligence for believing that that person was involved in a plot to detonate a nuclear weapon in London, and someone whom we had very good intelligence to believe knew who the other plotters were, where they were, exactly what they were going to do, and exactly when they were going to do it. Now, it's really no use at all in those circumstances talking about alternative long-term strategies to torture. That's not going to get you anywhere. You've got this man. He's in a room with you. You believe he has this information. You have no idea where the bombers are, or where the bombs are, or precisely when they're going off, but you have very good intelligence to believe that detonation is imminent. It's an extreme hypothesis, I grant you. But it's not an impossible hypothesis. And I think if you're engaged in serious discussion and consideration of this issue, you have to face up to this extreme moral, ethical, and legal dilemma. And let us suppose, to test it to its uttermost, let us just suppose that in those circumstances, the anti-terrorist officer and the security service officer engage in torture, engage in one of the activities that have been mentioned, which come within the definition of torture. And suppose, of course, it's not a certain outcome, but we're talking hypothetically about events that could happen. Suppose that as a result of that act of torture, they obtain the information which enables them, even in the short time available, to identify who the bombers are and where they are, and to prevent a nuclear attack on the centre of London. Is anybody telling me that that anti-terrorist officer and that security service officer are going to be prosecuted for a war crime? Is anybody telling me that that security service officer or that anti-terrorist officer is going to be prosecuted at all? I suggest that what would happen in those circumstances, and it's my answer to the dilemma, and it differs from the answer that Tom and his source have provided, I suggest that in this country at any rate, we have a legal system which enables a just conclusion to be reached in that extreme circumstance. What had been done was against the law. But the Crown Prosecution Service has to decide in all cases whether it's in the public interest to bring a prosecution when the law appears to have been broken. And I venture to suggest that it is difficult to imagine any outcome in those circumstances other than a decision not to prosecute the persons involved, despite the fact that they had, on my hypothesis, been guilty of an act of torture. Not everyone will agree with that conclusion, but I hope I've done enough to stir a couple of elements of controversy into our discussion.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we've had two fascinating contributions. We're now coming to general discussion. I'm going to begin, if I may, because I really want to focus attention on the points that have just been made and give both Tom and Michael an opportunity to make one further brief comment, if I may, before we open it up to further discussion. Tom, first of all, how do you deal with the point that Michael has just made? But Michael, you also, if you're in your scenario, the person having tortured the suspect finds that he doesn't have that information, or the information turns out to be wrong, does the conclusion still lead to there being no public interest in him being prosecuted for something he had no legal right to do in the first place? Let's allow Tom first, and then I'll come back to you, if I may.
You've made my point. Let me just say, definitions are simply splendid. The really difficult question we face is, what happens if a form of torture doesn't appear on your definition list? Is that excused? Is it open? The ability to maintain current a list of all forms of torture is a challenge, particularly in a democracy where you have to get people to agree. To some extent, we are left in, certainly my society, with the courts to decide whether a particular act violates the definition in the convention. And obviously, if that's incorporated in the criminal code, whether in fact that's been violated or not. Examples of things that might constitute violations, in my view, would be useful. An exclusive list of definitions to guide everyone forever would be problematic. The second point I'd just like to add, because the chairman has made my point, do we equally excuse the gentleman who in fact performed these heroic acts, but utterly failed? Not only that, They not only utterly failed, but they were misled, so that in fact they went off to Exeter or to Lincoln or some other place and spent all of the time that they could have spent actively seeking through other methods perhaps to find the weapon. And in fact, they allowed the tortured individual to in fact seal the act and hammer home the nail, if I could put it that way, by in fact responding to torture in ways that I have suggested that people under those circumstances might well respond.
Thank you, Michael.
Right. Well, on the first point, the fact that there's no perfect answer doesn't mean you shouldn't strive for a good answer. So I think a list of agreed acts that constitute torture would be a very important step forward. And you could keep it under review. You could have a body that would keep it under review and add to it from time to time. Of course, you won't get a perfect list. Of course, I accept that. But I think it would be a very important step forward and would give some meaning, some real significance to this debate on whether torture can ever be justified. Because unless you know what you're talking about in terms of actual acts, which may or may not constitute torture, I think it's a bit of an empty debate. Now, on the key question, what happens if the act of torture doesn't give you the information you need? I discount completely the fact that you may be sent off to Exeter. My hypothesis demands a situation in which you have no idea where the bomb is going off. And so you're no worse off, frankly, if you're misled. And anyway, you can be misled without torture being exercised. Your suspect or your proven terrorist, whichever he is, may say to you the bomb's in Exeter without any torture being exerted. So I completely discount that. But let's face up to the question. I'm anxious to try and face up to all these difficult questions, however hypothetical they may be. So the question is, what happens if a security service officer or an anti-terrorist police officer has used torture in an attempt to find out where a nuclear bomb has gone off but has failed? Well, of course, in one sense, the answer may not only be hypothetical, but may be totally academic, because if a nuclear bomb has gone off, no one's likely to be around to examine the consequences in any circumstances at all. But let's suppose, just tease out every possible scenario, let's suppose that in some circumstances the Crown Prosecution Service has the task of deciding whether or not such a person should be prosecuted. And let's suppose, I don't know what they would decide in those circumstances, I think it would be a very difficult judgment for the Director of Public Prosecutions to make. But suppose the Director of Public Prosecutions decided in such a case that a prosecution should take place. And the defendant, anti-terrorist officer or security service officer, says to the jury, yes, it's true. Yes, I did use torture. Yes, I knew it was against the law. I did it as a last resort. It's true that I didn't know whether it would succeed in achieving my objective, and in this case it actually didn't. But I did it because I was desperate to do everything in my power to save London from a nuclear detonation. What do you think the jury might be likely to do in such a scenario? And even if the jury convicted him, what sentence do you think the judge would pass?
This could be described as the Dick Cheney defence. Time will tell. Bruce Anderson.
I think we all agree that torture is an abomination. We abolished it in the UK roughly at the time we gave up burning witches. And it's for much of the last 300 years, it would seem as unlikely that we bring back torture as we start burning witches again. But the ticking bomb scenario now surely dominates it a bit. Sometimes in human life, it's not a choice of good and evil, it's a choice between evils. And that sort of choice is the sort of choice that conservatives will embrace because their view of human nature is best summarized in the phrase original sin. And I do not think we can be squeamish. I think Michael Hart should have the courage of his convictions. He outlined the scenario, the ticking bomb scenario, in which we don't just have the right to torture, I believe that we have the duty to torture. We have to have torture as part of our impotence. Now, the Bush and Cheney administration prevaricated over the use of torture, rather in the way that President Clinton prevaricated over the use of incels in the White House. I still think torture, although on a lesser scale, must be part of the armory of a civilized society trying to protect civilization. The stain that torture will undoubtedly leave on our society is less than the stain of this great city being a blackened ruin. And also, we should be grateful to Mr. Bush and Cheney. They did leave as a legacy waterboarding, which I gather is a very effective use of torture. The journalist Christopher Hitchens subjected himself to it, thinking he'd be able to claim that it was girly man torture. He aborted mission after 7 seconds, and it was tomorrow. So we may have found a form of torture that works. I think if we're dealing with a ticking bomb, however horrible the methods we have to use, we have to use them.
Thank you. Do either of us speak? Yes, yeah. Tom.
Look, the question we will never know the answer to is, if the bomb scenario is perfectly okay and the next one down saves 150 lives, and the next one down saves 50 lives, and then 25, and then one, why not authorize torture in all of those cases as well? So you're on a massive slippery slope. There's no question about it at all. And this is where Cheney and Bush were. There was no question at all about that. There was no question at all that in some cases, Mr. Cheney asserts, without ever being able to tell us yet, that torture was effective. They used waterboarding 183 times against one defendant before, in fact, they confessed to the Congress that that indeed was what they were doing. We don't yet know, although experienced interrogators have certainly made the case time and time again, that it is hugely against the interest of being able to carry forward the saving of lives on a long-term basis to engage in this kind of behavior. I would find it hard to disagree with Sir Michael if we could find the tightest definition of the case to say, we are about to lose London. Can we find an answer through that particular route? But my view is the law should be against it. What the jury and the prosecutors decide to do in England or the United States is clearly something we have no clear way of knowing in the long-term future. But the notion to me is abhorrent that you should, in United Kingdom law, begin to authorize the use of torture. It's a slippery slope. You never know where it ends. Mr. Cheney showed that very clearly.
Michael, briefly.
Well, I want to make clear that I disagree with Bruce and that I disagree with your characterization, Mr. Chairman, of my position. It's not at all. I'm not at all putting forward the Dick Cheney defense. I disagree with Dick Cheney completely. Dick Cheney and George Bush, as a matter of government policy, approved the use of techniques which I regard as torture. And I completely refute that, and I think that is absolutely wrong and improper, and it is very far away from my position. I think that is wrong. And in answer to Tom, I agree with you, Tom. I don't think you can frame a definition which would cater for the extreme case that we've been hypothesizing. I think the law has to be absolutely clear, with no loopholes, and the law must forbid torture as defined in a much more expanded way than the definition accepted by Bush and Cheney. I'm not on their side of the argument at all. But if you face up to the extreme hypothesis, and I don't think you can dodge it, I don't think you can avoid it, you have to try and work through what would actually happen. And I've tried to face up to that, and I've tried to suggest a way in which the courts and the prosecuting authorities would deal with that scenario. But the law should not have any loopholes, should not seek to define those circumstances. It should be absolutely crystal clear that torture is illegal.
Thank you. I sit contrite. Thank you very much indeed. Could questioners please briefly identify themselves? Lady in the front.
Hypotheses were so far-fetched that it's one feels reluctant to deal with them, but I think it's important to deal with one or two aspects of them. I think the point about definitions that you made is accurate, but for a slightly different reason. And that is this, that ultimately torture is the infliction of bodily pain such that the victim of that pain desires to say something, or perhaps say all that he knows. But it's predicated on bodily pain, on subjugation of someone in fear that they will then believe that it is worth saying for. Now, the problem with definitions is that it's very subjective. And people's threshold of pain is very different. So Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, apparently, on the waterboarding lasted 30 seconds, apparently. We know some of his information was quite useful. You say Christopher Hitchens lasted 7 seconds. So the definition problem will be that you will not be able to accurately define whether it works or not and whether the information. Second point is about the information. I think we all know that most people, interrogators, say that it doesn't actually reveal very much. The information you get is not very good. But I'll come to your point. You were asking about prosecution of the law. And I think that is an important point. And it's important because the agents of the state, first of all, there would never be one actor, but let's assume there's several in the room where the person who's meant to have the information about the nuclear weapon is. The agents of the state are meant to be accountable to their masters. When you have lone players deciding to take the interest of the state into their own hands, then you're on very dangerous territory. And the courts, my hypothesis of the courts is, I know it's difficult in these kind of forums to look to our EU partners, but let me tell you about the case in Germany of that.
Could you keep
child.
It fairly brief, please? Because
very briefly,
many others.
The child was kidnapped, and on fear of being murdered. The interrogators, the investigating team, threatened torture. The person gave them the information. They subsequently found the child, and the child was already dead. Nevertheless, the courts did try the interrogators. The difference was where they did use the legal system with some flexibility was they didn't use the jury.
Briefly, Michael, do you wish to respond?
No, I don't think there's anything there that I would really disagree with.
Okay, now, gentlemen at the back and then at the front. If you could, further back at the moment, please. Thank you.
First, a minor point.
Could you identify yourself?
Paul Ayers.
Thank you very much.
Tom, you mentioned that one of the unfortunate byproducts of torture is that innocent people are arrested. Well, under U.S. law, everyone who's arrested is innocent. The point, though, I would like to make more of it, is that in 1969, I was subjected to torture. I was involuntarily detained by U.S. authorities. I was subjected to a physical and psychological program of dehumanization. I was subjected to sleep deprivation, and I was threatened with my life. It was called being drafted into the United States Army. Now, the point that I would ask both of the speakers to address is this. The definition of torture, what constitutes torture, is one that seems to be formed by people sitting in lovely facilities like this, or librarians in Peoria. Your figures on it, you gave, or who supports it, who doesn't. What would those figures look like, and I ask both of you to address this, if you put the same questions to our soldiers, sailors, and airmen on the front line, to our policemen who are trying to deal with the problems of crime and terrorism in the streets, do you think those figures would still be the same?
Tom.
I think not, particularly for people in combat, but people in combat, as you've emphasized, have undergone a particular stress. We no longer have conscription. We may get it back if we're in a national emergency. And to some extent, people are asked to make heavy sacrifices, including the supreme sacrifice, to defend their country at a time when it's under attack. And I don't, in fact, believe that falls within the definition of torture, although extreme physical pain is the result of military combat, and we have divided those two pieces off, as you have said very clearly. And there is a distinction between those sets of actions and the situation in which they occur. I don't think one destroys the validity of the other in terms of the concepts that are involved, even though, in fact, one can find similar circumstances between them. And I would argue that we will never stop defending our country, nor will Britain, because of the torture convention.
Well, I agree with Tom. It's a colourful metaphor, but completely inapposite. Boxers suffer extreme pain and inflict it on each other. But I don't think you can make any comparison between boxing and torture, nor, I think, can you make any comparison between warfare, with all its horrors and with all its difficulties, and torture. They are completely different, and different rules do and should govern them.
Thank you. Front, and then other gentlemen at the back.
I think Ambassador Pickering was absolutely right.
Could you identify for the audience?
Stuart Weedon, sorry. Absolutely right to mention the slippery slope argument. And in fact, I think that argument was the reason why the Israeli Supreme Court reversed its decision. After the first decision, which allowed torture in very exceptional circumstances, it soon became the fact that virtually any Palestinian who was arrested became tortured. And I think that's a large part of the reason why it was resisted. And torture is so abominable that I prefer the second of Michael Howard's two solutions to the ticking bomb scenario. I think it's better that somebody who tortures should know he's going to be prosecuted and be prosecuted, and then the solution should lie in the sentence. Thus, as you take your child to hospital exceeding the speed limit when it desperately needs an operation, you'll be prosecuted and you'll be guilty and you'll get a conditional discharge. Similarly, I think that's the answer to the ticking bomb scenario.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Brian, I'm Sir Harry, if you're in the personal question. Two observations. Following up Professor Pickering's comment, also the last comment. By tacitly accepting that torture could be used in some very extreme cases, we are beginning to lower the threshold. And seeing the enthusiasm to embrace some aspects of criminal and civil war in UK, in particular, regulation of investigatory powers act. Powers initially to six security organisations, that's now stretched to 400, covering everything from rubbish collections to school admissions. There is a concern that once the threshold has been set, it will progressively be lower. And my second comment is one of historical nature. During the Moran Notice of 1948 to 1960, when there was a largely Chinese labour service in the Northern Peninsula, which was successfully counted, led by the civil police, supported by the military. At no time was torture used against many thousands of insurgents and also possible insurgents that were taken into custody. Now, firstly, that was a direction given at the time by the Director of Operations. And secondly, this was observed by the CIA with some incredulity that we did not use quote-unquote third-degree measures there. Having spent time investigating this and speaking to former special branch officers, they made the point very clear that it was completely counterproductive to attempt to torture people. They would tell you what they think you wanted to know. In fact, the interrogation methods, which are pretty robust by today's standards, nonetheless were very, very successful at turning these insurgents to come in from the government side. And part of the interrogation package was actually to correct these people, if I may use that term, get them to recount. Recant their communism, because amongst other things, they were British subjects.
Before I ask Michael to reply, it's interesting that although torture may not have been used in Malaysia, some of the people who were involved in Mau Mau in Kenya have recently claimed that they were subject to torture by British authorities during the Mau Mau emergency.
I understand why that was allowed to happen.
Yeah. Michael.
Well, you mustn't misunderstand my argument. I was not in favour of setting a threshold. I wasn't arguing for a threshold. I say again, the law should be unequivocal and without any loopholes, and it should prohibit torture. And the instructions given by senior officers of the security service, of the military, of the police, should prohibit torture. I wasn't even advocating, in the ticking bomb scenario, that the officers concerned should use torture. I was just trying to get everyone to face up to what would actually happen in those circumstances, and how the criminal justice system in this country would be likely to respond. And Stuart may be right that in those circumstances, the Director of Public Prosecutions would say there should be a prosecution, and the jury might convict, and the judge would then have to decide to take all the circumstances into account in setting a sentence. But I don't want anybody to misinterpret anything I've said this afternoon as being in any way a defense of torture. I haven't been defending torture at all. I've been criticizing it and attacking it and saying it should be made illegal. But I also think we have to face up to some of the implications of what we all agree is an extreme and hypothetical, but not impossible scenario.
Tom?
I think where we are is that it is not beyond the mind of man, not beyond the wisdom of a man, to invent some scenario that will confound all of the basic principles of our national legal system.
Yeah.
However far-fetched. And I think that that particular invention that you and I shared is one neither of us was very comfortable with, one that, at least in terms of its chances of happening, we hope are infinitesimally small, and where I think we both agree that the law should not be changed, that the law must stay and the law must be the law. We can then speculate on the question of the outcome, if indeed anybody survives.
Thank you. Sir?
My name is Dr. Hussain. I'm an academic researcher. My question is to Ambassador Pickering. There are two parts in the question. Number one is that it has become fashionable to discuss and condemn bad things when we are no more in charge of things. When you were ambassador, especially in 1988, the Intifada movement was culminating in Palestine. And more than 100, I'm quoting from Washington Post and New York Times newspapers, they reported that more than 100 people, they were tortured from 1987, end of 1987, to the end of 1988 in Gaza Strip and West Bank by the Israeli authorities, the defense forces, and the Israeli police. Now, when you were ambassador over there, you had some degree of moral obligation. So what were you reporting, how you were reporting these incidents to the Americans back in Washington, D.C., to influence the Israeli authorities to be a bit more humane? This is one question. The second question is that if we are talking so much at this time, and again, I mean, I was reading a newspaper article by Richard Taylor Norton in today's The Guardian, and he reported about Baha Moussa, who sustained 93 injuries and died. And is it not the time, that you use your good offices, Mr. Wright, Honorable Malcolm Rifkin, Michael Howard, and yourself, on an international forum to bolster the UN efforts to curb any sort of terror, any sort of torture?
Tom?
My answer to your first question is, absolutely, we were reporting it in May of 1987. I gave a speech with full authority 6 months before the Intifada at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem and said in that speech that there would soon be some kind of blow-up in Israel if Israel continued to treat the Palestinians the way they were being treated. It was not a speech in which I received universal encomiums, but many in Israel wrote me privately and said they were pleased that the United States was prepared to stand up. And one of the most, I think, committed members of the Likud, I'll be kind, called me an unfriendly ambassador of a friendly country. So there is no question at all, A, we were aware what was going to happen, B, we foreshadowed it, and C, we continued to report it, and D, we talked to the Israelis about the way in which they were dealing with it. So there was no question at all. We were not remarkably successful in changing Israeli points of view. I have to admit that. But I think it's important. Remind me of the second question very briefly.
Is it not the time that you...
Yes, that's why we're here. I came overnight, and I'm leaving in another 15 minutes to go back.
Thank you. Now, we only have time for two or three more questions. Yes, sir.
Both of you seem to imply that under the last administration, torture did take place, and the facts, as they are reported by various Senate committees, suggest that this was authorized at the very highest level. So, what is the of what value are such things as the International Convention Against Torture, which you described in detail, in dealing with what appear to be allegations of effectively state-sponsored torture, and where the situation is that where those who carry out those acts of alleged torture, or allegedly carry out other acts of torture, are possibly not to be prosecuted, either because they had the shield of advice from government lawyers that what they carried out was legal, or another set of government lawyers will decide that it's not in the public interest to pursue those prosecutions.
Tom. Let me say only this, that I have supported for months the idea that we need a commission in the United States similar to the 9/11 Commission and the Iraq Commission, to look into Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and the whole question that you framed, the full question. To some extent, there is no question at all that the present administration seems to be deeply concerned about the issue of accountability for, I think, a whole host of reasons, having very little to do with equity and very little to do with the question of justice and right or wrong, wishes at least at this point not to venture down that path. We have even tried to shape the commission idea so that it looks toward the future. What lessons have we learned that we ought to apply in our legal system and in our administrative system to prevent this from ever happening again? That so far has not yet been successful. There is now an issue in which the Attorney General, seemingly at the moment a little bit in opposition to the President, is at least prepared to look into this question now. So we will see where this goes. But I would support the notion, first and foremost, that we need to find a way to avoid falling into this morass once again. And whatever we can do to prevent that, in my view, is justified and worth doing. The issue of accountability in criminal acts is uniquely for the Attorney General. He is apparently addressing it. I'm happy about that. We'll have to see where that comes out. Michael?
Well, I don't really have very much to add to that. Safe to say, going back to one of the previous questions, that a new inquiry into what happened in Basra opens, I think, today, either today or yesterday. So in this country, we certainly are trying to get to the bottom of some of those allegations.
Any final questions? Yes, sir. Yeah, and one more at the back. That'll be it. Thank you.
Mark Bailey. I just want to make an operational point. The first one was made better by the RAF about the worthlessness of torture in British counterinsurgency experience, which is many decades. The other is the immense difficulty in finding people who are good interrogators. Finding good torturers will probably be even harder, but there are very few people who are good interrogators, and it has a proven success. It's been done before.
Thank you. Lady at the back, before I invite final comments from the speakers.
Yeah, my question is more for Sir.
That's me first.
My name is Maria Thina, I'm a Paris Research Fellow. I think it's a bit obfuscated, the framework in international law at the moment about the definition of torture, as you said. So we have the UN Convention. You're saying that the definition there is a bit vague, which obviously, if there are so many dissenting interpretations, must be vague. So what do you think is the next step? An amendment of that convention, a new European directive, a new international convention, a new UK law? I mean, what would be the answer to the legal framework? Because I think that's one very important part. The rest we can talk forever between ourselves in different forums, but at least if there is a law, then that's the source. That's where the amendment should happen.
Thank you. Final comments from our speakers. Michael first.
Well, my answer to that question I provided in my earlier remarks. I think we should try and get international agreement on a list of activities which would come within the definition of torture, which would therefore be prohibited. In conclusion, I just say that I think what this discussion has revealed is that even though we can, almost all of us, agree in principle, and the exception is not me, agree that the answer to the question, can torture be justified, is no, that actually the whole subject is a bit more complicated than that, not quite as simple and straightforward, and that there are more aspects of it and implications of it that need to be very carefully considered.
Tom.
I would only echo what's just been said. The answer still has to be no, that we have probably more work to do. Without making too fine a point of it, a definitional exercise would be useful but not conclusive. And I think we ought to be careful of thinking, in fact, that that is a magical answer to the problem.
Thank you very much. Now, this has not been a conventional debate, but I'm sufficiently curious. I'm going to invite a show of hands, just to satisfy my own curiosity. The question is, can the use of torture ever, and the word is ever, be justified? Now, those who feel it might be possible to justify it, could they please indicate? Thank you. And those against? And abstentions? Right, by a very large majority take the view that it cannot ever be justified. Ladies and gentlemen, I don't know what you feel. This has been one I find is one of the most fascinating meetings of the forum that I personally attended. And I'm extremely grateful, of course, to our two speakers, but also to you who have asked the questions. Got very high quality of interventions as well, and I think we've all learnt an enormous amount about the subject. I thank both our speakers, but I know Michael will agree with me in giving a particular thanks to Tom. Tom arrived in the UK this morning from the United States. He is now leaving for the airport to return. So we have been incredibly privileged to have his presence here today, and it's been, we've found, a most fascinating exchange. And Tom, I hope you have enjoyed it as well. Please join with me.
I have only a mild form of torture.
But entirely justified.